Hi, and welcome back. We're going to continue our discussion of Greek philosophy, which is where we are in the text of the Kuzari. It's Mimer 1, the first essay, and the first paragraph of Rebbe Yehuda Halevi, where the philosopher is really given the opportunity to explain his entire theology and ideology. I know that some of the things that I'm presenting now may sound very technical and a little bit cumbersome, but I guarantee that if you are able just to absorb the basic ideas that I'm presenting now, it'll be really very, very helpful in understanding how Rebbe Yehuda Halevi approaches the arguments of the philosopher and provides refutations of them. Last time we discussed how the philosopher tried to present to the Khazar king his conception of what he thinks is God, a God known as the prime cause, or alternatively the prime mover, who's completely unaware of human behavior in this puny corporeal world, and therefore activities like observance, worship, prayer, all of these things are meaningless to the philosopher because there's no God that's aware of what's going on. There's a God, but he's not interactive with this corporeal world. But let us recall that the king is on a quest. He is seeking, based on the angel's appearance to him in a dream, the proper path for living his life. Does the philosopher offer him this path? All we've seen him do up until now is tell him what God is not. So how does that provide meaning to the king who's looking for a way of life? Our immediate reaction, therefore, is how can philosophy offer a solution to such a quest? When I think of philosophy, especially from a 21st century perspective, I think of a course I may have taken in college. Religion is the thing that provides me with purpose and a sense of direction, not philosophy. But my thinking is such because we think of the word philosophy differently from what it meant 1,000 years ago. Back then, philosophy offered a holistic way of life. As one secular scholar of philosophy puts it, and I quote, "Philosophy was not one academic subject among others. It was a way of life. Each of the main philosophical schools claimed to provide a route to leading the happy life, more akin to a religion than those of an academic discipline," end quote. For the philosophers living in Rebbe Yehuda Halevi's time, one could achieve perfection through his or her intellect. And this is really where the philosopher is going. If you're looking for something meaningful in life, if you're looking to achieve purpose, then you do it through your mind, through the development of your intellect. And that's what makes you perfect. This effort can only be achieved by human beings who, according to the philosopher, have to be born with certain innate abilities, meaning it's not every human being that can achieve this. But once you are born with those abilities, you have the responsibility to hone those skills, those God-given innate skills, and you hone them through your intellectual and scholastic pursuits. The individual must strive to understand the physical and metaphysical realities of the universe. And once someone has achieved a certain prerequisite amount of knowledge, then that individual can achieve immortality, and that person's soul is bound to God. That's really the philosopher's presentation. So if we wanted to characterize the philosopher's solution to the king's quest in a nutshell, when the king says, "What is my purpose in life? The angel told me that I need to seek out true purpose and true meaning in life," the philosopher's response is very simple. Perfect your intellect, and a perfected intellect is what makes you closest to God. And here I quote from the Kuzari, subparagraph 19. "Once you have integrated this philosophy within yourself, you need not concern yourself with which specific dogma, set of rituals and other actions, and choice of words or language you will follow. If you like, you can even fabricate your own religion, which promotes humility, exalts the prime cause, helps you correct your traits, and does the same for your family members and your fellow countrymen, if you can get them to listen to you. Or you might adopt the intellectually stimulating rituals of the philosophers. But your ultimate objective should be purification of the soul so you can perceive things more accurately." Now, at this point, I'd like to discuss a term that the philosopher uses in this very first section of the Kuzari, which is somewhat foreign to most readers if you're looking at this for the first time. The philosopher presents a concept called the active intellect. It appears throughout the philosopher's explanation of his belief. In Hebrew, it's called ha-seichel ha-po'el, which literally means the intellect that is active or agent in a person's life. As we mentioned last time in trying to describe the model of the universe according to the philosopher, there are a series of concentric spheres endowed with, each sphere is endowed with its own sentience, its own intelligence. They are known as separate intellects, all emanating ultimately from the prime cause. And we explain that the lowest sphere's intellect is the thing that interacts most directly with this earthly existence down here on Earth. And the name that was assigned to this lowest of the intellects, this lowest of the emanations, was known as the Seichel HaPoel, the active intellect. In addition to maintaining the order of nature, it presents a goal, an objective for man, according to the philosopher. As we said, human perfection lies in the perfection of one's intellect. How does one perfect his intellect? Through speculation, meditation, and trying to apprehend the ultimate truth of all that is. Now, once a person succeeds in doing this, his own personal intellect, meaning the ideas that are contained within his own individual mind, attaches itself or conjoins with this intelligence, this active intellect. This, for the philosopher, is the key to immortality and to prophecy. When you've developed your own individual intellect sufficiently, your mind, as it were, attaches itself to the active intellect, and that's how you become immortal, and that's how you achieve prophecy, because now you're like plugged in to the source of all knowledge. And so I read from the last paragraph of the philosopher's words in the end of this first section, subparagraph 20. The philosopher says, in summation, seek purification of the heart with whatever method works for you, as long as you understand the principles of wisdom clearly. This is how you can attain your goal, which is to attach yourself to that ethereal entity, the active intellect. In doing so, the active intellect may supply you with prophetic knowledge about the future by showing you authentic images in dreams and in visions. Now, I just want to make a few very brief comments about the active intellect, because I recognize that it's a very foreign concept. There's no scientific validity to it at all in today's world as well. But just for us to be able to understand and appreciate where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is coming from. First of all, this concept is attributed to originally Aristotle, and it was something that was widely subscribed to in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's world of the 12th century Islamic Spain. However, it's important to note that really, if you look through Aristotle's writings, it's not at all explicit in any of his writings that there's this individual sentient being that is part of the consciousness of the lowest emanation of the prime cause. It was really developed as an interpretation of Aristotle by later generations of Greek and then Islamic philosophers. Second of all, it's important to note that one of the beliefs of Aristotle was that once a person dies, he loses all personal identity. That is, he loses what's known as the individuation of the soul. Because according to Aristotle, when you die, your soul dies with you. What is then immortal about the individual? The only immortal component is his intellect, which conjoins with the active intellect, and that is all that remains. But it joins together with all intellects in the universe, meaning that there's like this big pool of intellect, and when a person dies, his intellect travels into that pool and conjoins together with not only the active intellect, but all other human beings' intellects who have already passed from this world and are now conjoined with the active intellect as well. That's sort of like the philosopher's heaven. And that's why the philosopher can make the following statement in the middle of subparagraph 15. It therefore follows that anybody who has become one with the active intellect likewise never has to fear destruction. It is very comforting to know that one is in the same group as Hermes, Asclepius, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. If one reaches this level, then he and they and everyone else who reaches that level become a single everlasting unit, end quote. Now, for the philosopher, that may be comforting, but someone who believes in personal reward and punishment based on their behavior in this world, such a belief is quite discomforting, because the question, of course, is obvious. Where is the ultimate justice and recompense if not in the afterlife? If all we have to do is just develop and perfect our intellects and then we become immortal and we become part of this larger intellectual pool, then where's the individual heaven? Where's the individual schar va'onesh, the individual recompense that is due to every person that is exactly commensurate to his deeds, the just kind of judgment that we are known, that we know about through the Torah? As we will see, this explanation of the philosopher about purpose in life is completely unacceptable to the king, meaning the Khazar king is going to out of hand reject the philosopher's presentation of this is how you reach perfection in this world. And there are a number of reasons for why he's going to reject it, but in our next lecture we will explain the king's own argument as to why the philosopher's way of life, one which is devoid of any one set of discipline or regimented behavior, is unacceptable to him. What we should also consider at this point is there any way to reconcile this idea of the active intellect within Judaism? Were there indeed great Jewish thinkers who believed in the active intellect? Or was this whole concept of the active intellect necessarily consigned to a pagan system of the Greeks who glorified intellect as the end-all of everything? In other words, can a rabbi subscribe to the belief of the philosopher and also make intellectual perfection his ultimate objective in life while still subscribing completely 1,000% to the ways of the Torah? This is going to be part of the subject of our next talk.